You're listening to a Bible study by Jack Kelly. For more free Bible study resources, visit our website at gracethroughfaith.com.
So tonight we're going to begin with Revelation chapter 11, and we left off in verse 7, and so that's where we'll pick it up today. We're talking about the two witnesses. We made a pretty good case, as I recall, for the fact that these two witnesses are Moses and Elijah. At the very least, they are two who minister in the same spirit. The particular miracles that they perform and the particular things that they do and say lead us to believe that the greatest likelihood is that they are Moses and Elijah. And so that's the way we're going to take this. Not that it has any great significance to anything. It's just something that we feel like is most likely. And so we came down through the part of their ministry. We said that the 42 months that they minister is not necessarily the same 42 months as the Great Tribulation, because the Great Tribulation, which is, as you know, the second 3.5-year portion of the 70th week of Daniel, has not yet begun. Everything we've talked about up until here, up in this first 11 chapters, takes place in the first half of that 70th week. The Great Tribulation, we're going to see the beginning of the Great Tribulation tonight. It begins in heaven in a few verses here, and on earth it begins in the next chapter. And so we'll see the beginning of the Great Tribulation here tonight. And so we'll be starting the real, a powerful part of the book in just a few verses here. So the two witnesses appear before the beginning of the Great Tribulation, and their ministry ends before the end of the Great Tribulation. So while it's a 42-month, which is the same as 3.5 years, while it's a 42-month ministry, it sort of straddles the 70th week of Daniel. And it doesn't begin at the beginning, it doesn't end at the end. It sort of overlaps both portions. All right, now when we get to verse 7, we'll see that their ministry is about up. And so verse 7 says, "Now when they have finished their testimony, the beast that comes up from the abyss will attack them and overpower and kill them. And their bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which is figuratively called Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified." And so that tells us exactly what the name of the city is. The Lord was crucified just outside the city wall in Jerusalem. And so even though the city is called figuratively Sodom and Egypt, its actual name is Jerusalem. Now why call it figuratively Sodom and Egypt? Sodom for the sin that takes place there, and Egypt because of the fact that it is a worldly city. Always through Scripture, when Egypt is mentioned symbolically, it's a type of the world. Verse 9, "For 3.5 days, men from every people, tribe, language, and nation will gaze on their bodies and refuse them burial." Now, that's a verse that couldn't have happened until a few years ago. And our ability to see that verse fulfilled is due primarily to the efforts of Ted Turner, because CNN will make this possible. People from all over the world can now see news as it happens, right? And we remember during the Iraq War, we could see the attacks taking place as they happened. We could see the bombs falling from the planes, and we could look through the eyes of the pilots and see the actual bomb going into the window of the building, blowing up, the building disappearing as it happened. So it's only in the last few years that this would have been possible. But because of CNN, and of course the other networks are involved in it as well, verse 9 can come true now. And so for 3.5 days after they are killed, they're killed in the street, left lying there, and for 3.5 days, men from every people, tribe, language, and nation will gaze on their bodies and refuse them burial. That is the greatest insult that you can give to another person in the Middle East. Killing them is not bad enough. It's worse to refuse them burial. It's an ultimate sign of disrespect. And so these two witnesses are killed there in the streets of Jerusalem, and they're just left lying, and their bodies are left there. They refuse to bury them. Verse 10, "The inhabitants of earth will gloat over them and will celebrate by sending each other gifts, because these two prophets had tormented those who live on the earth." Now, this concept of giving gifts, you know, even now, when you see something happening in the Middle East, it's mostly true in the Arab culture. When there's been some great attack on Israel or something like that, you'll quite often see in the Palestinian territories people giving each other candies. It's a method. Yeah, it's a method of it's a means of celebration. And so I think that's what they're referring to here. The people are so happy that these two have finally been shut up that they give gifts to each other. It's the only time in the whole book of Revelation where we see anybody on earth happy about anything. And it has to do with these two witnesses. Let's there's an interesting psalm here. Let's turn to Psalm 79. I want to read you part of Psalm 79 because it's a kind of an interesting commentary on what's happening here. Psalm 79 verse 1 says, O God, the nations have invaded your inheritance. They have defiled your holy temple. They have reduced Jerusalem to rubble. They've given the dead bodies of your servants as food to the birds of the air and the flesh of your saints to the beasts of the earth. They've poured out blood like water all around Jerusalem. And there's no one to bury the dead. And so there's an interesting parallel there. Now, of course, the psalm was written 100 years before the Lord was born, or 1,000 years rather. And so we don't see anything in that time frame happening like this. So we have to assume that this is prophetic, a prophecy of something coming up, and probably this something is in the 11th chapter of Revelation. All right, verse 11 now, back in Revelation 11 and 11. But after the 3.5 days, the breath of life from God entered them, and they rose and stood on their feet, and terror struck those who saw them. And then they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, come up here. And they went up into heaven in a cloud while their enemies looked on. And so this is a model of the resurrection of the tribulation saints. And so as the two witnesses are martyred, and as they're left lying there, and then all of a sudden brought back to life, this is an indication of the resurrection of the tribulation saints. All those who martyred during the Great Tribulation coming back to life and coming up into heaven. The voice, come up here, is the very same voice that John heard in chapter 4, you remember, when he was told, come up here. And of course, in chapter 4, we saw this as a model of the rapture of the church. Here we see it as a model of the resurrection of the tribulation saints. The 3.5 days they're left lying in the streets are meant to symbolize the 3.5 years of the Great Tribulation, which is coming. Now, verse 13, at that very hour, there was a severe earthquake, and 1/10 of the city collapsed. 7,000 people were killed in the earthquake, and the survivors were terrified and gave glory to the God of heaven. Now, that's kind of an unusual way to state it. A clearer way might be to say that these people said, this is the work of God. In other words, they gave him the credit for it. Not necessarily that they're bowing down on their knees and praising the Lord for these judgments. It's saying, okay, we know who's doing this. This is coming from the Lord. Something similar to this happened back in the days of the Exodus. If you look in Exodus chapter 8, verse 19, you see the same kind of thing happen. Exodus chapter 8 and verse 19. Now, I think we're into the third plague, and this is the plague of the gnats. Now, the Lord tells us in the scripture that the plagues are judgments against the gods of Egypt. Every one of these plagues is a judgment against the gods of Egypt. And of course, the last plague, the death of the firstborn, is a judgment against Pharaoh, who claimed to be the chief god of Egypt. And so up until now, the priests of Egypt have been able to produce a reasonable facsimile of the plague that Moses produced. He turns water to blood, they turn water to blood, and so on. We get to the plague of the gnats, and what happens is the whole country gets infested by these gnats, these little lice-like, including the priests. And it renders them ceremonially unclean. So they can no longer solicit their God because they're not clean now. They're not fit to be in the temple, in the temple soliciting his help in this. So they've been separated off from the God that they worship. And in verse 19, the magician said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. But Pharaoh's heart was so hard, he would not listen, just as the Lord had said. And so here they have them saying, we know who did this. And it's kind of a warning to Pharaoh to say, you know who you're messing with here? better tread lightly. But of course, his heart was hardened and he would not listen. And so the plagues went on. And that's the last you hear of these two. Yeah, they're done for now. and there's no more defense against this, these plagues, and there's no more attempts to show that they're not anything special, because the priests of Egypt have recognized that this is coming from God Himself. This is His handiwork. Now, when you get to 2 Timothy 3, 6 and 7, you learn the names of these two priests, Jambres and Jairus, are the names of these two priests of Egypt. I think I pronounced them right. It's in 2 Timothy chapter 3. Let me get there and see if I pronounced them right for you. Jannes and Jambres. Verse 8, just as Jannes and Jambres opposed Moses, so did those, so also these men opposed the truth, men of depraved souls, who as far as the faith is concerned are rejected. And so those are the two priests of Egypt who warn Pharaoh about this. That's just a little something that will help you win a Bible trivia question. And so your salvation doesn't depend on knowing that. So so just a little extra credit information there for you. Okay, now, you know, we've been in the trumpet judgments here, and there have been these three woes yet to come, as it was explained to be in chapter 11. Now, verse 14 says, the second woe is past, and the third woe is coming soon. Now, verse 15, chapter 11. The seventh angel sounded his trumpet, and there were loud voices in heaven which said, the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdom of our Lord and of His Christ, and He will reign forever and ever. And verse 16, the 24 elders who were seated on the thrones before God fell on their faces and worshiped God, saying, we give thanks to you, Lord God Almighty, the one who is and who was, because you've taken your great power and begun to reign. Verse 18, the nations were angry and their wrath has come. The time has come for judging the dead and for rewarding your servants, the prophets and your saints and those who reverence your name, both small and great, and for destroying those who destroy the earth. In heaven, this is announcing the fact that the Lord has begun His reign in heaven. Now, of course, it's going to be 3.5 years before He comes to earth to begin His reign here, but that doesn't matter. As far as the Lord is concerned, the time has come and He has begun. And so everything's starting here in heaven. In another few verses, into the next chapter, we're going to see the Antichrist beginning his reign on earth. And these two things happen about at the same time. But the Lord has begun to reign here in heaven. Now, I think I showed you this when we were back in Revelation 1. But when you get to verse 16, it says, the 24 elders who were seated on the thrones before God fell on their faces and worshiped God. This is one of the seven appearances of these 24 elders, who we say are representative of the church, having appeared first of all in Revelation 4 and appear throughout, always in heaven. You know, and the logic we use there is elders are an office that specifically relate to the church. These elders are sitting on thrones. Priests never sat on thrones. Throne represents rulership. And so these are kings who are also elders. They're dressed in white. They're wearing crowns. All these things lead us to the conclusion that they are representative of the church. And they have been in heaven here since Revelation 4. And they say, in verse 17, we give thanks to you, Lord God Almighty, the one who was and one who is and who was. Now, this is not a complete recitation of his title. All the way through the Bible, it says the one who is and was and is to come. But now it's only the one who is and was, because there is no more is to come. He's already come. And so he is still in heaven, not on earth yet, but his time has come. And the ultimate fulfillment of the prophecy of His second coming is beginning to unfold. All right, and down in verse 18, he says, your saints, rewarding your servants, the prophets, and your saints, and those who reverence your name, both small and great, and for destroying those who destroy the earth. Okay, the real culprits, the real people who are destroying the earth, are not those people who drive SUVs. The real people who are destroying the earth are the people who have rebelled against God and who have created the situation where this huge judgment has come to take place now, and the earth is being judged and in the process prepared for a restoration. In Jeremiah chapter 30, I think I've shown you this before, Jeremiah chapter 30, verses 1 through 11, we see the purpose of the Great Tribulation. And its purpose is twofold. Now, they've mentioned one of them here in the in Revelation 11, but I'll show you them both. It's in verse 11 of chapter 30. Basically, the first 11 verses are an explanation in the Old Testament of the Great Tribulation up until Matthew 24, when Jesus coined the phrase Great Tribulation. This period of time was always known as the time of Jacob's trouble. It was the time when Israel was going to be purified in preparation for the kingdom. And so that, of course, would be one of the purposes of the Great Tribulation. In verse 11 of chapter 30, Jeremiah, it says, I am with you, Jeremiah speaking to Israel, I'm with you and will save you, declares the Lord. Though I completely destroy all the nations, which among which I scatter you, I will not completely destroy you. I'll discipline you, but only with justice. I will not let you go entirely unpunished. And so there you see the twofold purpose of the Great Tribulation, to completely destroy the nations that rebelled against God and who have persecuted Israel, and to discipline or purify Israel in preparation for God's return to dwell with them like he promised. And so there you see, this is now beginning to happen. Verse 19 of chapter 11 in Revelation. Then God's temple in heaven was opened, and within his temple was seen the Ark of his covenant. You wonder where the Ark of the covenant is? Well, there you go. It's in heaven. Actually, we would learn that by doing a study of the book of Hebrews, everything on earth is a copy of what's in heaven. The tabernacle, the implements, everything is a copy. When Moses came down the mountain with the Ten Commandments on those two stone tablets, he had them tucked under one arm, and under the other arm he had a set of engineering drawings for the tabernacle. And the last thing the Lord told Moses before he came down the mountain is, he said, now see that you build this exactly like I showed you. So Moses saw the real one. Now he was told to come down and let's make a replica of that for earth. So everything on earth is a shadow of that which is in heaven. Hebrews 8:5 is the authority for that. If you want to take a quick look at that, that way, if anybody asks you, where'd you get that kooky idea? You can say, well, it's out of the Bible. Hebrews 8, starting in 3, every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices, and so it was necessary for this one, speaking of Jesus, also to have something to offer. If he were on earth, he would not be a priest, for there are already men who offer the gifts prescribed by the law. Verse 5, they serve at a sanctuary that is a copy and shadow of what is in heaven. This is why Moses was warned when he was about to build the tabernacle, see to it that you make everything according to the pattern shown you on the mountain. That's a quote from Exodus 25:40. And so everything on earth is a copy of that which is in heaven. And so when you see this verse 19 in Revelation 11, you see the Ark of the Covenant in heaven. Is that the Ark of the Covenant that was in the tabernacle? Maybe. Or is it the real one, of which the one on earth is a copy? I tend to believe the latter. And so, by the way, when you get to the Millennial Temple, there is no Ark of the Covenant. So it really isn't necessary that they ever discover it. They don't ever have to find it, don't ever need it again, because they got the real one in heaven to start with. And secondly, it doesn't appear in the Millennial Temple, so we don't have to worry about that. And he says there came flashes of lightning, rumbling, peals of thunder, an earthquake, and a great hailstorm. These are signature actions by God demonstrating that the judgments are from him. Every time you see judgments from God, you see these things accompanying it. Lightning, thunder, earthquakes, and a hailstorm. This is God's signature. This is how he says, this is from me. You see all these things together. This is from me. And so when we got the great tsunami over there in Indonesia last year, 2 years ago, and people said, is this a judgment from God? Well, in a sense, you could say that. But was it accompanied by lightning and thunder, earthquakes, and great hailstorms? Some yes, some no. And so it wasn't one of the signature end time judgments, but it was one of the judgments that comes on earth periodically. As Jesus said would happen, he said there'll be earthquakes, and there'll be storms, and there'll be pestilence, and those things are going to happen all the way through the age. They're like birth pangs. They get closer together and they get more severe, but they don't mean the end has come. The end is still to come after these things. That brings us to the end of chapter 11. So let's zing right into chapter 12 now. A great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. All right, now this whole idea, a great and wondrous sign, the sign tells you that it was not literal. This is not a literal woman sitting up there in heaven with all this accoutrement. This is a sign, a symbol, and it symbolizes something. And so what we have to do is try and figure out what this symbolizes, because, you know, way back in the beginning of the book of Revelation, what did John say as he was writing it? He says, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place, he made it known, that in the Greek that says he rendered it into signs. And so, and I think the King James says he signified it, which means to render it into signs. And so that tells you the book of Revelation is highly symbolic in nature. A lot of the things that he's describing to you are symbolic of something. They're not necessarily real things. And so there isn't necessarily a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet and a crown of 12 stars on her head sitting up there in heaven. But it was a symbol of something. And our job, of course, is to figure out what it is a symbol of. So let's read on and we'll find out. But first, in verse 3, another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his heads. In verse 4, his tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to earth. And the dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that he might devour her child the moment it was born. But she gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. And her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the desert to a place prepared for her by God, where she might be taken care of for 1260 days. All right, now I think it's becoming clear who the woman is. Because the woman gives birth to a male child who will rule the nations. Doesn't yet, but he will rule the nations with an iron scepter. And so that gives us a clue. Whoever this woman is, she's the woman who gave birth to the Messiah. But you remember, things are not literal here. Things are symbolic. So in the symbolic sense, who was the woman who gave birth to the Messiah? Out of whose people did Messiah come? Came out of the Jewish people. Okay, now you're getting there, because the woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars. This reminds us of a vision that Joseph had back in Genesis 37 of his family bowing before him. And he shows the family in the form of the sun, the moon, and the stars, 11 stars. And so he's the 12th one. And so the sun was symbolic of Jacob, the moon, symbolic of the woman, and the 12 stars, symbolic of the 12 children. And of course, those 12 children became the children of Israel, became the nation of Israel. And so it was the nation of Israel who gave birth to the male child who would rule the nations. Now, some people try to sell you the idea that this woman is the church. And if it is, she's got a problem, because the church is supposed to be a virgin bride and this one's pregnant. And so we got a problem there. But the church didn't give birth to the Messiah. It was the other way around, right? It was the Messiah who gave birth to the church. And so it can't very well be the church. Scripture, I think, shows pretty clearly that the woman is Israel. Okay, now the other sign, the enormous red dragon, we'll read on here in a minute, and it'll tell us who this one is too. Verse 7, and there's war in heaven, and Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, the same dragon, and his angels, and they fought back, but he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth and his angels with him. And so the other sign, the red dragon, obviously it was not a fiery dragon with seven heads and ten horns and all that, but symbolically symbolized Satan. Okay, so you've got the woman giving birth to the child. You've got the dragon being Satan trying to devour the child, because the first thing Satan wanted to do when Jesus was born is to get rid of him, because if he can get rid of the Messiah, then he can stop the redemption of mankind, then he wins and God loses. And so there was that big battle against them for all that time. But she gave birth to the son, a male child. Her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. And that's, of course, the ascension after the crucifixion and resurrection. That word snatched up to God, by the way, is the very same word that we use on 1 Thessalonians 4, translated rapture. And so it's the very same word. He is taken by force, taken quickly, and the same way the church will be taken up. And so it's the same idea. Now there's between verse 5 and verse 6, there's a 2,000-year gap. It's one of the 24 places in Scripture where you see a big gap between one event and the next one. The Scriptures go on like it didn't happen, but 24 times in the Bible you see these prophecies, one of them relating to the first coming, one related to the second coming, and they just don't skip a beat. They go right from one to the other without saying anything. But those gaps, 24 of them, consistent with the 24 elders, are always periods of time into which the church fits. And there's 24 of them in the Bible. And this is one. Verse 6 now, it says, again, the woman fled into the desert to a place prepared for her by God where she might be taken care of for 1,260 days. 1,260 days is 3.5 years. It is the length of the Great Tribulation. Now in Matthew 24, when Jesus announced the concept of the Great Tribulation, and he talks about the fact that it's coming, he says, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, in verse 16. And so he's telling them to flee into the mountains. Here it says the woman fled into the desert. It's the same idea, because where she goes is into the mountainous region just east of the Dead Sea, in the country we know today as Jordan, which is the place where the beautiful rose city of Petra is, and that's the place where most people feel that the believers are going to flee to at the beginning of the Great Tribulation and be taken care of there. Now, if you turn back to Daniel chapter 11 with me, I want to show you something interesting, because we think of the Antichrist having control of the whole earth, but in Daniel chapter 11:40, it says, at the time of the end, the king of the south, that's the Egypt, will engage him, the Antichrist, in battle. And the king of the north, Syrians, will storm out against him with chariots and the cavalry and great fleet of ships. And he, the Antichrist, will invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. He'll also invade the beautiful land, that's the euphemism for Israel. And then the next, in verse 41, the next sentence says, many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. Now, Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon. Edom and Moab are the countries that Jordan is today. Jordan is made up of countries that way back when were called Edom and Moab. The leaders of Ammon are the Hashemite family, of whom King Abdullah is the current head of Jordan. Jordan is called the Hashemite Kingdom, and the Hashemite people apparently play a role here in hiding the Israelites and the believing Jews, I should call them, at the end of the age. And for some reason, of course we know the reason, for some reason, although the Antichrist has control over pretty much the whole of the world, he doesn't get control of that one area, and that's the refuge of the believing remnant that flees out of Israel as the Great Tribulation begins. Now, we're going to come back to Daniel, and we're going to look at the early parts of chapter 12, so don't lose your place there. Keep one finger stuck in that spot, or put a little page in there or something, do something, because in a few minutes we'll be coming back to there. Okay, and verse 7 says there's war in heaven. Well, the Great Tribulation is not only the greatest war ever been fought on planet Earth, it also is fought in heaven. and Satan, who's had access to heaven all through the age. The Lord's finally had enough and said, okay, you're out of here. And he gets Michael, and Michael and his forces mount up a battle against Satan and his forces. Michael, his forces are victorious. Satan is expelled finally from heaven. No longer will he be free to go up there at his pleasure and accuse the brethren, which is what he does. The name Satan, by the way, is not his name. It's his title. It comes from the Hebrew ha-satan, and it means the accuser. His real name is Hillel ben Shakar, the shining one. And you get that from the Hebrew of Isaiah 14. But if you go around saying Hillel ben Shakar, nobody's going to know who you're talking about. So everybody just calls him Satan. They call him by his title, not by his name. And of course, we're talking about the devil here. Satan will indwell the Antichrist, as we'll see here in just a minute. But we don't know the identity of the Antichrist. But the idea of Satan, yeah, we know that he is a fallen angel. Isaiah 14 and from Ezekiel 28, we know that he was probably the most powerful figure in heaven next to the Lord. He was the most powerful of all the created beings. And it's him who led the rebellion against God. And that's what it's talking about here when it says his tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky. It's from here that we speculate that when he rebelled, about a third of the heavenly host sided with him and rebelled with him. And so that's where his forces come from. Those are his forces now. And I got to be careful here. I'm reading a fascinating book on this stuff, and it goes way off into things that I'm going to have to do a lot of research on before I dare talk about them. But it sure is exciting. It sure is exciting. If even half of it's true, it'll be amazing. Okay, so then Satan is finally cast out of heaven and cast down to earth. Now, in Luke 10:18, Jesus says to the disciples who are just returning from one of their missionary trips, and they're all excited because they say, Lord, look, even the demons obey you, and in your name we were able to cast out demons. And of course, he says, you shouldn't be surprised by that, and that shouldn't be the thing that excites you. He said, what ought to excite you is that your names are written in heaven. And so he can't do anything to you. But he says, I saw Satan fall like a star from heaven. And he uses words that are pretty much right out of the Revelation, which shows us that he has the ability to look forward in time and see things happen in advance. And so he saw that happen, and he talks about it in Luke 10, verse 18. He also makes mention of it in John 12:30. Where he says, because of him going to the cross, he says, now the time has come when Satan can be expelled from heaven. All right, now at the moment when Satan is tossed out of heaven, that is the time when truly the great tribulation begins on earth. Because now Satan, as we'll see in a few minutes, has been cast down, and he's confined now to earth. And he has to vent all of his fury here, because he can't go anywhere else now. He's like confined to earth. We're going to see this as we read on, so let's just go on. Verse 10. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ. For the accuser, which in Hebrew is ha-satan, the accuser of our brothers who accuses them before our God day and night has been hurled down. They, speaking of our brothers, they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb, and by the word of their testimony. They did not love lives so much as to shrink from death. Therefore, rejoice, you heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to the inhabitants of earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you, and he's filled with fury, because he knows that his time is short. Okay, so now you see this distinction I've been telling you about all the way through the Bible, all the way through the Revelation, how John separates humanity into two groups, those who dwell in heaven and those who dwell on the earth. And those who dwell in heaven, you always see them being blessed, and you always see them saying, go get them, God, and everything's coming along just the way it's supposed to, and prophecies being fulfilled before our eyes. And the inhabitants of earth are subject to these great judgments because they are the ones who have refused the pardon that was offered them. And so now they are left to, having sided with the devil, they're left to suffer in his fate. Yes?
Who's the
the earth and the sea, when it talks about those, it says to the inhabitants of earth and the sea. And so it doesn't, you could separate the two, but in Revelation 20, it talks about the sea giving up the dead that were in it. And so you have apparently the sea or the abyss, the abode of the dead, may be connected here. Okay, now we're going back to Daniel 12, and in the first few verses, we talk about the same thing that we just saw happening in the book of Revelation. Daniel 12:1 says, at that time, the time of the end, Michael, the great prince who protects your people, and he's speaking of Daniel, and so your people are the Jewish people, will arise, and there will be a time of tribulation such as not happened from the beginning of nations until then. And that's, of course, quoted by Jesus in Matthew 24:21. But at that time, your people, the Jewish people, everyone whose name is found written in the book, these would be Old Testament believers, will be delivered, and multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake. And so here's a talk of the resurrection of those who died in faith before the Messiah came. Their resurrection takes place at the end of the Great Tribulation. A certain sample of them went out of paradise into a heaven with Jesus after the resurrection. Remember how we talked about that before, didn't we? How when he died, he went to this place called paradise, which is the abode of the dead, and the faithful dead are there, and they were being comforted by Abraham. When he died on the cross, and the thief next to him acknowledged him, he says, "Today you'll be with me in paradise." That means that's where he was going. He was going down to the abode of the dead. Nobody could get into heaven before then, because until his blood was sprinkled on the altar in heaven, the sins of mankind had not been effectively handled yet. They'd only been set aside by the blood of bulls and goats who were sprinkled on the copies of the heavenly things on earth. And so that all that did was set everything aside until this could happen. The morning that Jesus came out of the tomb and Mary ran up and grabbed him, he says, "Don't cling to me. I haven't yet ascended to my Father." He was going up there as our high priest to sprinkle his blood on the altar in heaven, getting rid of the barrier that had prevented everyone from going to heaven. And now he's going to come, when he comes out of the grave, he's taking all these people from paradise, all the ones who died in faith, the Old Testament, all their spirits went to heaven with him. Now, at the end of the Great Tribulation comes their resurrection. What's that mean? That means they get their new bodies, just like we get our new bodies at the rapture. And so those who died in faith of the Old Testament, now at the end of the Great Tribulation, they get their resurrection bodies. They are the ones who were going to populate Israel during the millennial kingdom, because God promised that he would come back to earth to live with them in the land. And so that's what's going to happen. Now, Daniel also is the first, this is the first place where the mention of two resurrections take place. Because he says, some to everlasting life and others to shame and everlasting contempt. We're going to learn at the end of the book of Revelation that the dead are resurrected at the end of the millennium, which is 1,000 years later. Everybody who ever lived gets resurrected. They all come back to life. Some come back to everlasting life, either at the rapture when the dead in Christ rise first, or at the end of the Great Tribulation when the Old Testament faithful come to life. They all get resurrected. All the non-believers get resurrected at the end of the millennium. They get resurrected to face their final judgment. And so, to me, that'll be the most surprised group in the history of mankind, because here they are. They've been dead all this time, and all of a sudden, boom. Of course, as Ken is fond of pointing out, they won't notice the passage of any time, because out of body means out of time. But anyway, this is the first place where this two-sided resurrection takes place, both the faithful and the unfaithful. All right, but that's the angel describing to Daniel back 500 years B.C. exactly what we've just read in the book of Revelation that's going to happen still future to us. All right, verse 13 now. When the dragon saw he had been hurled to earth, he pursued the woman, Israel, who had given birth to the male child, because now his only hope is to eliminate, to wipe out Israel. Because, you see, there's another technicality of the law. In Matthew 23:37, Jesus has been pronouncing these, what's called the seven woes on the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. It's an interesting passage, Matthew 23, because they have accused him of all kinds of things. Now he's going to turn the tables on them. He's going to start accusing them of some things. And then at the end of that, in 23:37, he says, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who stone the prophets and kill those sent to you, how I would love to gather you under my wings as a mother hen gathers her chicks. But you were not willing." And he says, "See, your house is left to you desolate. You will not see me again until you learn to say, Baruch haba b'shem Adonai, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." And from that we learn that Israel has to petition him to return. Well, if the devil can annihilate Israel, leaving no one left to petition him, he's won. And so that's why he's filled with fury here, and that's why he's going after the Jewish people with all his might and fury. Go back to Hosea. Hosea, can you see Hosea? Right next to Daniel, one book to the right. And we're looking at Daniel at Hosea 5, and we'll see the prophecy of this event taking place. 5:15, this is Messiah speaking, "Then I will go back to my place." Now, before you can go back to it, you have to come out of it, right? So this is him. He's come out of his place. He's come out of heaven onto earth. Now he's saying, okay, I'm going back now. I'm going back to my place until they admit their guilt. Now, the Hebrew there denotes one specific sin. They have to admit one specific sin. Guess what it is? It's the execution of the Messiah. And many believe that Isaiah 53 is their confession. That when they say, he grew up like a tender shoot before him, he had no beauty or majesty that was attracted to him, though we considered him cursed, he was sent by God and all that, and though he had done no wrong, we executed him, and though he was innocent, he made no defense. All that from Isaiah 53 is said to be their confession. This is their admission of this guilt. And he says, "And they will seek my face, and in their misery they will earnestly seek me." And now Hosea 6 is them speaking now. And this is when they say, "Come, let us return to the Lord. He has torn us to pieces, but he'll heal us. He has injured us, but he'll bind up our wounds. After 2 days, he'll revive us, and on the third day, he'll restore us, that we may live in his presence." A lot of people take the 1,000 years equals a day thing from Peter, and they say, okay, after 2 days, that's the 2,000 years of the church, and the third day, that's the millennium. And that fits because it's going to happen there. After the 2,000-year age of the church, Israel gets revived. We see that beginning to happen now. And in the third day, the third 1,000 years, the millennial kingdom, Israel is restored, and he comes and dwells in their presence. And that's just exactly how that characterizes it all here. And so you see that prophecy there, tie that to Isaiah 53, tie that all to Satan's fury here at the Jewish people, because now his only hope for a success in his eternal plan here to become like the Most High, like he said in Isaiah 14, he said, I'm gonna erect my throne above the throne of the stars and of the heavens, and I will sit in the sacred assembly, and I will be like the Most High. This is his stated objective. This is his goal. This is his plan. Everything that he's been doing has been driven by this vision, is that he is going to be like the Most High. Well, the only way he can do that now is to wipe out every last living Jew. He's got to prevent them from petitioning the Lord to return. And of course, that is the reason why God has provided a refuge for them that he can't get to, so that God can prevent that from happening. And that's what it talks about in verse 14. "The woman was given the two wings of a great eagle, so that she might fly into the place prepared for her in the desert, where she would be taken care of for a time," that's 1 year, "times," that's two more years, "and half a time," that's a half a year. You got 3.5 years now. That's right straight out of Daniel 12, time, times, and half a time. It's a very specific Hebrew construction, meaning 3.5 years, out of the serpent's reach. "And then from his mouth the serpent spewed water like a river to overtake the woman, sweep her away with a torrent. But the earth helped the woman by opening his mouth and swallowing the river that the dragon had spewed out of his mouth." Verse 17, "The dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to make war against the rest of her offspring." Guess who those are? Those are the Gentile believers left on earth at the end of the age. Those who obey God's commandments and hold to the testimony of Jesus. All right, so ends chapter 12. And now you've got the great tribulation all set. Now all the players are in place. Kickoff's been held and the game is underway. But we only got one team on the playing field. Chapter 13 is when the other team shows up. And chapter 13 starts out very ominously. This is where, if we were in the old days of the silent movies, they'd have the organ player playing his dun 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 dun. You know how they do? It says, "And the dragon stood on the shore of the sea." Now that means that Satan has been expelled from heaven. He's down on earth. The sea is always used symbolically to speak of the Gentile nations. The land is always used symbolically to mean Israel. The sea is always used symbolically to speak of the nations. And so when you see him standing out of the sea, standing on the shore of the sea, his focus is on Gentiles. And then it says in the second half of verse 1, it says, "And I saw a beast coming out of the sea. He had 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 crowns on his horns, and on each head a blasphemous name." Now remember, when you go back to verse 3, the red, enormous red dragon had 7 heads, 10 horns, and 7 crowns. The beast coming out of the sea has 7 heads, 10 horns, and 10 crowns. All right, so what's the deal here? The number 7 is very important symbolically, as is the number 10. They both denote completion or fullness. 7 from a spiritual or heavenly perspective, 10 from an earthly perspective. And so the number 7, when used of spiritual things, like the sevenfold Spirit of God, which is an Old Testament idiom for the Holy Spirit, means the sevenfold Spirit means the complete, the divinely complete Spirit of God. It's the Holy Spirit. When you get down to earth, the number 10 denotes completion from an earthly standpoint. So the ten horns, horn means power in symbolic language. So 10 horns means he has ultimate power on earth. The 7 heads means he has supernatural intelligence, because the head is the home of the brain, the seat of intelligence, and the 7 is divine, complete. So he's got supernatural knowledge. 10 crowns denotes rulership, and so he has complete rulership. Not only has complete authority, but he's also in charge. It's not only a supernaturally derived authority, but he's been put in charge by people on earth. Okay, so that's what all that means.
In my Bible here, it says there were 10 diadems.
Yes. Crown, a diadem is one of the two Greek words for crowns. And the diadem is the crown of the king. The Stephanos, the other word, is the crown of the overcomer, the victor. That's what they gave to the Olympic champions. They gave them Stephanos crowns, the ivy wreath. Just means they were victorious. The diadem means they hold the position of authority. They're an official ruler. Okay, verse 2 now. "The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear, and a mouth like that of a lion. And the dragon gave this beast his power and his throne and great authority." So this is the point at which the Antichrist is indwelt by Satan. As the Antichrist emerges out of the nations, Satan is standing there waiting for him, and he conveys all of his power and authority, both natural and supernatural, onto this guy. Now, the leopard and the feet of a bear and the mouth of a lion. If you went back to Daniel 2, we're not going to take the time to do that tonight because you're probably familiar with it already, but if you went back to Daniel 2, you would see Nebuchadnezzar's vision of a statue. Okay, and you saw that they had a head of gold, and then they had the chest and arms of silver, and then the body of bronze, and then the legs of iron, and the feet of iron mixed with clay. You go over to Daniel 7, and you see that same concept, because Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar that that statue represented all the kingdoms of the earth. The head of gold was Babylon, the chest was of silver, that was Media Persia, the belly of bronze, that was Greece, and the legs of iron was Rome, and then the iron mixed with clay in the feet was another version of Rome that would come at the end of the age. These are the four Gentile kingdoms of history. There are only four. You go over to Daniel 7, and you see the same four kingdoms coming up out of the sea from God's view. Now it's not a beautiful statue of gold and silver and bronze. Now it's four wild beasts coming up to just do terrible devastation to earth. And the first one was the lion, and that represented Babylon. The next one was the bear, represented Media Persia. The third one was the leopard, represented Greece. And so this king, this Antichrist, it says, resembled a leper, had feet like a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. That means he has got the all the power and authority of all these ancient kingdoms have been rolled up into under his rulership now. But if that wasn't enough, he gets his authority from the dragon. And it says in verse 3, one of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. Now, there's an oxymoron, because you can't heal a fatal wound, right? I remember once when I had some employees, and I had this gal working for me, and I noticed a scar on her leg one time, and I know she was a bike rider and things like that. So one day we were talking about bicycling and things, and I said, well, is that how you got the scar? Did you have an accident on your bike? She says, no, that's the scar. I had terminal cancer. And I said, you had what? She says, I had terminal cancer. I said, excuse me, terminal cancer means you die, and you're still alive. I can see that you had cancer, and you say that the scar comes from that, so it must be they operated on you and got, she said, it was terminal. She would not let me off of that. She said, I swear to you, it was terminal. I said, okay, all right. It was. From all appearances, it appeared that it had been slain, but it had been healed. This is viewed by many as a counterfeit resurrection that really gives the Antichrist his power and authority on earth. Because, see, only one person in history has ever died and come back to life, and that's the Lord himself. And now the Antichrist is going to claim to be the Lord, and so what better way to demonstrate that than to have the same thing happen? He appears to have died, now he's back to life. And so a lot of people see that as a counterfeit resurrection. And it works. The whole world was astonished and followed the beast. And this is verse 4 now. Now some also see it, the seven heads being part of seven kingdoms, but I don't see it that way, because I think the number 10 is the one that refers to the kingdoms, and there are 10 kingdoms on earth at the end of the age, and so I think it's more likely that. But it appears to all the world as if he has been assassinated, is the word I'm trying to think of, and then he comes back to life. Now there's an interesting little verse in Zechariah that gives us a little bit more insight on that. We ought to go and look at that. Let's see if I can find it here. Now in Zechariah 11, starting in verse 17, Zechariah 11 is a vision Zechariah is given on two shepherds for Israel. And one shepherd appears to be the Messiah who is rejected. And the other shepherd appears to be the Antichrist who is accepted. You remember the Lord standing there just before his arrest? He said, I have come in my Father's name, and you have accepted me not. Another will come in his own name, and him you will accept. Now, he's talking, first of all, about the fact that in a couple of days, at his trial, they're going to reject him and accept Barabbas. Barabbas will get freed out of the traditional clemency at Passover. Jesus will not. And so that's the short-term fulfillment. But the ultimate fulfillment is, having rejected the Messiah, the Christ, they will accept the Antichrist. And so the second shepherd is seen as symbolically the Antichrist. And I'm going to read at verse 17. Woe to the worthless shepherd who deserts the flock. May the sword strike his arm and his right eye. May his arm be completely withered and his right eye totally blinded. Now this appears to some people to be the effect of this resurrection. Is not complete. From that point on, his right arm doesn't work very well, and he's blind in one eye, but he's come back to life. So it's not a perfect, it's not a complete resurrection. It's another one of those things that gives us the idea of a counterfeit. It's not as good as the one God could do. It's a counterfeit. All right, but there's a whole lot of controversy that surrounds all of that. But because of that verse in Zechariah 11:17, people thought that Gorbachev was the Antichrist because he had that birthmark on his forehead, and it looked like he'd been hit with a sword there or something. And so a lot of people thought, well, that was one of the signs. Yeah, it was. And so those crazy things people come up with. All right, so the whole world follow him. Men worship the beast. This is verse 4. Worship the dragon because he had given authority to the beast. And they also worship the beast and ask, who is like the beast and who can make war against him? In other words, this guy is absolutely unbeatable. Verse 5. The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies and to exercise his authority for 42 months. There's the 3.5 years of the Great Tribulation. And he opened his mouth, in verse 6, he opened his mouth to blaspheme God and to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. So there's a reference to those who have been taken to heaven. He was given power to make war against the saints and to conquer them. And he was given authority over every tribe and people and language and nation. All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all whose names have not been written in the book of life belonging to the Lamb that was slain from the creation of the world. He who has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to go into captivity he will go. And if anyone is to be killed with the sword he'll be killed. This called for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. All right, several points here. 2 Thessalonians 2:4 is Paul's contribution to all this, where he says that the son of perdition, his name for the Antichrist, will stand in the temple, proclaim himself to be God. And that's the verse 5, utter proud words and blasphemies to exercise his authority. In verse 18 of Matthew 16, if you remember, when Jesus asked the disciples, who do people think I am? And some said Elijah and some said the prophets. And then he asked them, well, what about you guys? Who do you think I am? And Peter says, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus blessed him for this and says, you know, you didn't come up with this on your own. My Father in heaven put this into your mind. And he said, from now on, I'll call you Peter. And on this rock, I'll build my church. And the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And so here you've got some saints on earth being conquered by the Antichrist who comes from the gates of hell. The gates were where the people of authority sat. The town hall, basically, was in the gatehouse. And whenever you went, you wanted to see the rulers or elders of the city, all the cities had big walls around them, you went to the main gate, and in the gatehouse was where the elders of the city sat. You could always find them there. So if you had a question or dispute you wanted settled or a matter of law you wanted dealt with, you always knew where to find them. It's like going to the county courthouse today where you want to see the officials who govern you, you go to city hall, you go to the courthouse, whatever, and this is the same idea. And so the gate was where the authority was. So when Jesus said the gates of hell will not prevail against it, he meant the rulers could not prevail against the church. But here you've got the saints being conquered. Well, the obvious answer to the question is, there are saints who are not part of the church. And it's true, there are Old Testament saints, they aren't part of the church, and there are tribulation saints, they're not part of the church. The church is a unique group, all of its own, doesn't live here anymore at this time. The church is the people who dwell in heaven that he's uttering all his blasphemies about, because all the way through the Great Tribulation, he's hounded by this question. He can't come up with an answer for it. What happened to all the people? Where did all those people go? Talking about us in the rapture. He can't explain it. He can't tell them that. He probably knows, but he can't tell them. And so he has to keep coming up with answers. Lies. And you know how it is when you come up with lies. Somebody won't believe you. They'll keep asking you the question. And so that's the concept that's taking place here. But the most important part for you to see is that when he says he's given power to make war against the saints and conquer them, he's not talking about the church. Now he says that he who has near, let him hear if anyone is going to captivity and so on in verse 10. What that means is that this time is going to run its course. This is a clear indication that there will be a full 1260 days of this judgment. Now, some people read Matthew 24:22. I don't know if you've heard this one before, but Matthew 24:22, I believe it's where Jesus said, if those days had not been cut short, no one would survive, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. And they read that and say, this means that the Great Tribulation is not going to run its full time. The Lord's going to shorten it. Well, I don't believe that because there are just too many references to this thing running its full course. And this passage in Revelation 13 tells the same thing. The translation of that passage could as easily read, if I hadn't put an end to this at its appointed time, nobody would survive it. But for the sake of the elect, we're going to stop it after a period of time. The period of time is the 3.5 years that they keep talking about. But if they didn't come and stop it and just let it run its course, not a single human being would survive this judgment. And so what I believe he's saying there is while it'll last 3.5 years, it won't last any longer than that. All right, then verse 11, now we're down to. Then I saw another beast coming out of the earth. Notice, coming out of the earth. Now, some of your translations will say out of the land. Is that right? Some translations say out of the land, some say out of the earth. Okay, if in some places this is referred to as being out of the land, and some people use that to say, well, that means this guy, the second beast, comes from Israel, because remember, the sea is always the Gentiles, the nations, and the land is always Israel. But in my translation, it says out of the earth. And he had two horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. All right, now who do you know who is referred to as the lamb? Jesus. Okay. And two horns like a lamb, which means he has some authority. So he looks to people like he might be the lamb, but he actually is the dragon. And he exercised all the authority of the first beast on his behalf. And he made the earth and its inhabitants worship the beast. This one we're going to see is called the false prophet, whose fatal wound had been healed. And he performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven. So he's playing like he's Elijah again. And because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the first beast, he deceived the inhabitants of the earth. 2 Thessalonians 2:9 says that the coming of the lawless one will be in all kinds of lying signs and wonders that deceive those who are on the earth. He ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And he was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast so it could speak and cause all those who refused to worship the image to be killed. So you either bow down before this image or you die. He also forced everyone, great and small, rich and poor, free and slave, to give themselves a mark on his right hand or on his forehead. Now, your Bible says to receive a mark, but literally the Greek says to give themselves. So that means they voluntarily do this. So that no one could buy or sell unless he had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of his name. Now, all the way through all of my time as a Christian, there have been new technologies come, and each new technology is thought to be a fulfillment of this prophecy. Remember when credit cards first came along? And if you ever looked at your credit card down there, you know it's got a bunch of numbers across the back. And if you take the 16 numbers that are on the front and you put a couple more numbers with it, you got 18 numbers, and that's 3 times 6 and 666. And then they came out with the universal price code, the UPC code, which is in effect 3 sets of 6 numbers. And so people say 666. And then they come up with Ronald Wilson Reagan. 3 names, 6 letters in each one. Henry Kissinger, Prince Charles. All these people that under some rule that people make up with their combination of their shirt size and their inseam length and their mother's maiden name and several other things come up with somebody being 666. And the thing about it is, we don't really know. Nobody knows. That hasn't been revealed to anybody that I've heard of yet. But when it happens, it'll be some kind of a mark. Oh, the latest one is the chip, the RFID chip that can actually be injected under your skin. They're chipping dogs now so you can't lose them. Some people are having their medical histories chipped into their wrists or into their arms or someplace. There's banks that are doing this where you can have this chip implanted under your skin. You can walk through the front door of the bank, and before you get to the teller's window, she's got your account accessed. She knows what your balance is. She knows the name of your dog. She knows how your uncle's doing. And Okay, so all this stuff is coming. And who knows? But the point I'd like to leave you with is I don't think we understand exactly what this means yet. But there is coming a day when, unless you take that mark, you will be excluded from the economy. You won't be able to buy groceries at your grocery store. You won't be able to sell whatever you sell at the store you own. You won't be able to earn money. You won't be able to spend money, in other words, and you'll be completely cut off from the economy as a means of trying to bring everybody into compliance, into the worship of this Antichrist at the end of the age. Not any of us will be here for that, no. These are the people who are left behind, that's right. There won't be any church. There'll be Christians, but there won't be any church. Because there are people who come to faith after the church leaves, probably more than are in the church. But it'll be a real rough time. I'm telling you that you wouldn't want, even your worst enemy, you wouldn't wish this on even your worst enemy. Let's do this last verse here, and then we'll be finished with chapter 13. That's where I wanted to stop tonight. This calls for wisdom, verse 18. If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast, for it's a man's number, and his number is, and in your Bible it says 666. It's not the way it reads in the Greek. It reads 600 plus 60 plus 6. And so it's three different numbers, 600 and 60 and 6. Now, if you take the Greek language, here's a new one that's come up. And this is the most intriguing one, I think, yet. If you take the Greek language, the word Titan in Greek. How many of you saw the movie? Remember the Titans? And it was about a football team. And, you know, Titans were child offspring of Greek gods who came to earth and married human women. It's the Greek mythology version of the Nephilim from Genesis 6. Titan is actually the Greek rendering of the Babylonian word Shaitan, which comes from the Hebrew Satan. And so they were thought to be demonic back in those days, and they were thought to be this intermingling between the spiritual or angelic demonic beings and humans. There's been that's gone through all the mythologies, and at first, of course, was mentioned in the Bible. But in Greek, the word Titan has a numerical value of 666. And so that's the latest thing that people have come up with, that the return of the Nephilim, which is kind of a takeoff on Matthew 24, where he says, as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be in the coming of the Son of Man, which leads some belief that at the end of the age, we'll have another case of these Nephilim coming on earth, superhuman, super powerful beings that take over earth and try to wrest control of it away from mankind. And so that's a good one for you to look at. But the whole idea here is that something's coming at the beginning, or as soon as the Antichrist congeals his power, consolidates his power, is a better way to put it, he will, through this false prophet, enforce worldwide worship of him, and he'll tie that to participation in the economy, and he'll use it not only to track people, but also to discover people who are not going along with it, so that he can do something to get rid of them, because he knows that two groups of people on earth are not going to be willing to do this. One are Orthodox Jews, and the other are evangelical Christians. And so, these two groups of people represent the greatest threat to his, to the accomplishment of his plan on earth, so he's got to get rid of them. So the way to get rid of them is to exclude them from anything so that they are totally unable to survive, except by the good graces of people who help them at peril, at risk of their own lives. And that's what he's cooked up here. And that's one of the first major acts of the Great Tribulation. And so that brings us to the end of chapter 13. And what do you know? We're just a few seconds short of our magic number. So let's stop here. And next time, we'll pick up at chapter 14. And we'll take it from there.
Thanks for listening to this study. For more free Bible study resources, visit gracethroughfaith.com.